I just want to say how deeply appreciative I am of seeing you all. You warm my heart. I have friends here of decades, and I just deeply, wherever I teach, this is my home. You know, this is where I am nourished, and where I feel ground, the most ground in my teaching. I was telling Suze before we started that last week I was doing this in Boston. I flew in and I did a day long and I flew out. So it was a quick trip. And I wasn't sure what would come out because I haven't spoken Dharma talks. I haven't given a Dharma talk since May of this year. And it came out very easily. So I'm hoping it continues this week. But at the end of it, I thought, you know, not having the pressure of making this a vocation makes it a love. And I'm a different quality teacher when it's coming from that. And I thought, oh, I'm a better teacher than I've ever been because I've retired. So. So to the subject we're going to be going into today is contained in the book, and of course it will just be a touch upon those topics that are contained in the book. But it's something, here in Seattle, several years ago I gave 40-some talks on the Satipatthana Sutta. It took 2 years. And those talks were not transcribed into the book. This book was freshly written. But it was that series of talk that brought the formative teaching into a model for a practice model for me. Because I never really understood the Satipatthana Sutta. It felt disjointed. It's like, practice mindfulness in this way, and then you can practice mindfulness in this way, and you can practice mindfulness in that way. And it didn't seem to flow together. It didn't seem to be joined. It didn't seem to have a central message to it all. And because of that, I thought, I must be misreading it, or the history of my interpretations of it has just been skewed. So I did a kind of a research on it, but I didn't find anyone's understanding of that model to be much different than I was taking from it during those talks. So I said, okay, there's got to be some cohesion here. There's got to be some way that the Buddha is saying something beyond four ways to develop mindfulness. And then it came from asking that question, it came. And so I'm going to give you a sort of a rundown of that model today in the brief time we have. And it goes, of course, into much more depth in the book. And in the book is also exercises that will help you understand the model that I'm suggesting. It's an interpretation. You know, when you look at a piece of art, there's no one way to interpret it. It doesn't hold a single representation, a single truth. It holds a variety of truths, so because everybody brings their mind to that piece of art. So this is an interpretation. It's a way of looking at this teaching from my point of view that makes it a cohesive whole and takes us in the direction that the Buddha is pointing. And it moves seamlessly from one foundation to the next. It doesn't feel disjointed at all to me. Now I'm here because I want to deliver that message to the people, to the students who I care most about, yourselves. I'm also here to benefit Sims. No, I'm not, whatever you put in those baskets is not going to me. And I would like you to be very generous in this holiday season to giving whatever you can afford to those baskets. I can talk about Donna differently when it's not personalized, when it's, I'm not receiving any of it. And I do hope that you are generous in your offerings. It's very important to me. I did this at CIMC too. It's not so important to me now to receive money from the activities I do. It's very important to me to know that as I'm dying, that these organizations that hold the foundation of the Dharma together survive and persist over time. And I'm just hoping that you feel that same level of commitment to this organization as I do. And to see it move forward is very important. So please be generous today. Now, I want to start because what I'm going to say is not going to directly, it's not going to be personally directed. That is, some of you are going to feel like, what's he talking about? Some of you are going to be able to follow my talks right on through. Some of you are going to feel pushed and challenged by what I say. And some of you are going to miss what I say because your practice maturity is not quite to the place where I'm pointing. That does not matter, okay? If it's how you handle the message that's coming in, if you feel discouraged about it, then you're handling it wrong. If you're saying, oh, I'll never understand what he's saying, don't do it that way. Feel that this is accessible, will be, if it's not immediately accessible, at some point in your journey deeper into the Dharma. So even if it misses you, it's fine. I remember very clearly in my 20s going to a Zen talk by a renowned Zen master and didn't understand a thing he was saying. I thought, this is missing me completely. And yet I knew, I didn't get discouraged. I said, okay, there's something to this. I can feel there's something to this. And that's what I want even those of you who miss the points being made to feel there's something to this. Because that's an encouragement. That will drive you forward. That is the stimulus for your growth. Whether it hits you dead center as I'm speaking it doesn't matter. It's that you don't get discouraged through the listening. Okay? So that's important. Okay, so let's dive in, huh? Okay, first thing we have to understand is what the Buddha's doing here. And to understand that, we have to understand the fix we're in. And what's been helpful for me, scientifically, is to understand how it is that this cerebral cortex, the brain, creates what it sees. Because if it creates what it sees and what it sees isn't accurate, is in what it's creating is accurate to what it perceives, then fine, we can get on with our business and dislike one another. But if it's a misperception, that should rankle us. That's like a stone in the shoe. You know, it's like, I can't live life hobbling along here knowing that the way I've organized life is being misperceived. So we have to understand, okay, let's just look at how the senses form and then the ideas are expressed from that. You know, if sense of touch, taste, we're talking about all the senses now, are electrical stimulations, right, organized by the brain. It's not as if the brain perceives what is being seen. It coordinates or organizes all the sense data, and may I say there are over a billion electrical impulses arriving at the brain at any particular time from all the different senses, and it organizes that data in some mysterious way into a summation, into a logical conclusion about what it expects the world to look like. That makes it dependent upon the neurological imprints, and it makes it dependent upon the memory associated with the images that it's taking in order to organize itself into a logical way to move forward. Right? That's all. It's very simple and it's very scientific. So that we get a sense that we, you and I, the sense of us, never actually perceives the world at all. We've never been able to directly perceive life, the reality of life at all. We have never been able to do that. All we've ever been able to do is to coordinate the neurological stimulations, the electrical impulses of the neurons, into a summation of what we think all of that electrical stuff means. So we've always been distant from life. We've never really touched it. Now, when I saw that in myself, I thought, whoa. That bothered me. Because that makes whatever is being summarized conditional. Because it's based upon the memory banks of past associations so that I can go forward. It's not like I'm seeing immediately. I'm seeing what the mind depicts in the moment, and then from my memory bank, I move forward or against whatever the reality that is summed in that moment. But I never really perceive it. In fact, the sense of I, okay, so this is, the sense of I is formed in that memory bank. Because I have a whole set of logical conclusions that I formed from the past through similar situations, there's a sense of me having pre-existed to this moment. Because the memories are concurrent with the particular data that comes in. In fact, the neurological pathway for perception, this is science again, not me, is the same as a neurological pathway to perception. Recognition, perception, and recognition are the same neurological pathway. In other words, when I look through my eyes in this moment, I don't know whether I'm recognizing what I'm seeing or perceiving what I'm seeing. Recognition carries the past of what I've seen with it. Perception would be just the electrical impulses, you see? And if you look around, you can see the reason that we know everything is because that recognition factor is so strongly paralleled to the perceptual one. Now that's a problem, because we are locked into life unable to really perceive how it is. Because concurrent with those perceptions are the recognition of what life has meant to me in the same configuration in the past. And all of the emotions I've conditioned into this particular moment, or similar ones, as well as all of my ideas, which has a whole file cabinet storage bank, so that everything I do is relevant to what I have done in the past and what I'm going to do going forward. And I'm only presenting this to show us the packaging that all of us bring to the present. And the assumptions inherent within all of that package is that you're there and I'm here. That's how the mind has organized the perceptions, starting when we were very small. Because if you're hearing something and you have a memory of what you've heard before that's similar to what you're hearing now, there's got to be a you in there that has lived prior to this moment, based upon the fact that that memory is occurring. And so there's an assumed sense of me that's perceiving the entireness of this situation, the entirety of this situation. and feels as if from that positionality that you're different, you're distanced from me, you're separate from me. And you're separate from you, and things are separate, and objects are objects, and subjects are subjects. Now that's just the problem. That's just the layout. That's like the teacher says, okay, we've got to land on the moon. And here's the problems we have to get to the moon. That isn't the solution. That's the four foundations. The Buddha moves us through that problem beautifully. In fact, when I really connect with it, it brings tears. It does. It's that beautiful. It's that miraculous. And his intention in moving us through the reality that we have lived within, that we have conditioned into ourselves, that reality, and moves us through the four foundations at each step with greater subtlety moving us out. I call that path from the central place where we find ourselves in the beginning, form. Form, formation. We're formed. I'm a formed person. And the formations is all I know about the world. Because that's all the memory will allow those perceptions to contain, is what I know about them. So formation, forms, is where we start. Now I could call that the mundane, and we could be traveling to the sacred. Or I could call it suffering, and we're traveling to non-suffering. Because if you're formed, you're going to collide. Objects collide, billiard balls collide. They have different opinions, different views, different histories, different ideas about going forward. That's the formula for collision. And if you need any proof, read the paper. Okay, so that's the given. But I change the words a little bit here, and if you're interested in how suffering parallels form, and how the formless parallels non-suffering, it's contained in one of the first chapters of the book. I parallel those two so that there's no dispute between those words. So I go from form to a world of this. And mostly when we have a sense of something more that life could contain, something more to life. We don't know what to call it, and we only know what the mind is doing to us, and we use what the mind is doing to us to try to get out of form. The problem is that the mind is formed, and it won't let us out of form. It should be a television show. It was at one point, and I can't remember, The Prisoner or something, years ago. I'm 70, so you don't remember it. But it had to do with somebody who couldn't, never mind. The point is that it holds you within its scheme, because you think, the problem is we think we can do it. Okay, I see the problem with the brain, now I'm just going to apply some different practices and I'll escape from this thing. No, because the sense of escape, the sense of me, is what we're escaping from. That's what freedom is. And we're trying to take ourselves along with us. We're trying to carry our form along with us to transcend to the formless. But there's no getting out of oneself. There's no getting out of oneself. There is a reperception. A reperception of what the self is. Now, how can we reperceive when recognition and perception are one and the same? It's just if that's fooling myself, if I think I can reperceive, right? Because all I'm ever going to perceive is what I already know. Not true. And that's the one shining star here. That's true north, is to know that there is a way to perceive that isn't governed by the conditional landscape of things, by the recognition that we already have of life. That's what's so amazing about this. There's only one thing that allows that transformation to occur. Awareness. Awareness. In a very important sutta, someone comes to the Buddha and says, "What's the locus of the senses? Where can all the senses be held, be seen?" He said, "The brain. From the perception of the brain, all the senses come into the brain." And the man says, "What's the locus of the brain? What is there a vantage point from which everything that happens to the brain can be seen?" The Buddha says, "Yes, awareness." What he is saying there is that the awareness is not a neurological stimulation. It is not of the brain itself. It is free of the brain and therefore can perceive what the brain, what is occurring within the brain. Now, science can stimulate the brain, and it can stimulate the aspect of the brain that has emotions, has attitudes, has beliefs. The whole range of mental phenomena can be stimulated from those different electrical inputs. But it has never found a neurological response that stimulates awareness. Because it's not of the brain. And it's because it's not of the brain that we can see our conditioning. And it's because we can see our conditioning that we can know the difference between recognition and perception. And that's what frees us. You see, if you look around in the room, you'll recognize everything. Now, if you're quiet with what you're seeing, and you just bring awareness to what you're seeing, you'll hear what that object is from memory, but that's a thought, and that can be just allowed to be a thought. And if we're quiet enough, sufficiently quiet, you can see color and shape. And that's the electrical stimulation of the perception, because that's what the perception is bringing to the brain, color and shape. But that color and shape does not separate itself from whatever is next to it. That's the brain that does that, because in marking something as an object automatically has boundaries to it. But awareness does not put the boundaries to form and shape. It just sees. So it doesn't make everything homogeneous to see with awareness. It just doesn't make everything distant and separate from one another. And if you need to do something so that you can make it all work for yourself, you can come back into recognition and know that these are glasses. That aspect of reality, of relative reality, isn't abandoned, nor would you want it to be. But if you don't need to know where your glasses are, there's a deep, settled quietude that can come to us that was never available when you only knew glasses, coat, chair, ceiling, floor. Me. Now, if we're quiet enough together, which I hope we are, we can begin to sense that transformation happening in the room. Because we're no longer compelling ourselves to see things the way we have always known them to be. And as we relax that muscle, you'll notice that the sense of you will also relax. The more relaxed the muscle of what you see, the less the sense of seer as a whole, as a characteristic, as a separate thing, emerges. Doesn't that make complete sense for what I've been saying? Because it's through the recognition and exactitude and a knowledge I invest in things that give me the sense of being knowledgeable and separate from. You see, these two things arise together. You and I arise together, my friends. You may not like me, but we're here together. So as we began to relax with that, a couple of things. One is, we've only known life through our investments into objects. That's all we've known for most of us, except when we were very young and didn't know what an object was. They're swimming in the wonderment, but you just don't have we don't have the memory to remember that swimming. And everything from after that became very dutifully learned, and our image and recognition became tied to our self-image and to our vocation, etc., etc. And quiet too was left behind, because what good was it? What good is quiet? What good is stillness? Doesn't get me what I want, doesn't promote me in my field of learning, doesn't give me the recognition I feel I deserve, doesn't honor my emotional history, doesn't give me self-certainty. Okay? Is it any wonder that we keep the recognition of the perception foremost in our minds? Is it any wonder that we are reluctant and perhaps fearful to release the knowledge that we have about the world in order to discover that stillness? No. And this is what seems to make the journey so long. The journey is contained in a single perception. We don't have to go somewhere. It's not about finding a new location or discovering a new guru in Nepal. It's about shifting perceptions. That's all. And the fear that we have in doing so, that's why it requires heart. You can't force this. This is why I think I'm a better teacher, is I really understand that fact. And before it was like, come on, you know, you can do this. It's just fear, you know. I was bringing my understanding to your position, which was never helpful. And I realize now that each one of us are exactly where we need to be, doing exactly what we should be doing in terms of our spiritual journey. And we're facing the dragons of our own mind in trying to move forward. Because we've cast out what it means not to be us when we don't feel like we've really been us. We've never been me. I've never been recognized. No one's ever seen me. I don't have recognition sufficiently to give myself up. Okay, so now, first foundation. See, this is what the Buddha, he has us claiming the body. Forget anything you've known about the physical experience of the body. The first landing of our attention in our body claims self-reference. I am here. This is where I belong. This is who I am. It's the Buddha touching the earth. I have no dispute now. There's no apology for being here. This is the only place I can possibly be. This is my location. I have found myself for the first time. That is sanity. That's level one, first step, sanity. From here, all the other steps are accessible. Without sanity, nothing is accessible. Nothing is accessible. We're just trying to run from the self-disappointment, from self-dissatisfaction. We're trying to run from, get out of ourselves, get out of our skin. You can't do that. You have to start with sanity. First step, in the body, sanity, locating ourselves, the coordinates of the world, of where I am, X and Y axis, perfectly positioned right there. And for once, if we allow that teaching to bless us, instead of looking out through our despairing eyes and saying, oh, he's further or she's further along than I am, I don't know, I'm always. See, that's just bringing insanity to the first step. The first step is the step of sanity. Here's what I've got, here's what's going on. Let me bring the first touch of awareness to what's going on. The light touch of awareness to see myself now as not being pushed by circumstances, but being able to hold the circumstances that have always pushed me. And now that's a step into quietude, which is deeper sanity. Every time we accentuate the awareness over the turbulence of what is being said to us from our emotions that are running amok and our thoughts that are so compelling, all of which are just electrical stimulations that keep us into ourselves, into the summation, into the idea of what we are and what we've always been. That's what all that does. It just keeps repackaging us. And every time we think we're in a period of quiet, guess what happens? Out comes some kind of memory of how mother did this to me, and now, wow, I'm right back into that old. And there's no way out of the mind. You can't force yourself to be different. Okay, so this is so key. And no one ever told me this. This was self-discovered. I mean, because the step of sanity has you examine the impact that my reactions have upon insanity, and that every time I go back into the field of the lost sense of me, the disparaging sense of me, then I'm acting from the world of recognition, not from perception. And any action I take from recognition just deepens the conditioning of that recognized factor. That I can't force my way through this. It is not of my will, because that just hardens the conditioned influence, makes it more obscure, really, less available. And believe me, that most of us have to go a long time before we discover that truth, before we land on that truth. Because this is a realization. This whole practice moves from realization, from actually experiencing it, seeing it, feeling it, ingesting what we see, not from an intellectual approach. Intellect doesn't change a thing. In fact, it just hardens the conditioning, because the intellect just adds to the knowing I have about myself, which does nothing to the fact of what we are. It just hardens that fact. Are you following all this? Let me just tap in. Okay. I know it's hard, but I only come out here once a year. I don't want to make it like, you know, it's got to be challenging. Maybe a while before you see me again. So as we realize that we're up against ourselves, basically, that's a very sobering idea. But let me just show you in a very quick way, and I know I've used this example before. In fact, you probably have heard all of this before. Let me show you how out of control we are in our thoughts of being in control. We think we are in control. We think we're in control of our practice. Okay? So we're sitting and we're following our breath, and suddenly our mind is carried away by thought. Now, if we're sincere, we didn't ask, we didn't deliberately think, it took us away. Right? So we weren't in control of being lost. We got lost, right? Okay, so you're not responsible for the fact that your mind loses you. Okay, now listen to this. When we wake up, we think we control the fact that we awakened out of thought. But that thought about awakening out of thought came after we got out of thought. It didn't come while we were trying to wake up. Oh, I'm back. That's after the fact. So we weren't in control of waking up. We weren't in control of going to sleep, and we weren't in control of waking up. So what in your practice are you in control of, my friends, if it's not that, at that level? You see, this whole thing has always been out of our control. But there is something that we do have that is the driving energetic force of moving forward, which is not willpower, it's intention. And intention comes from seeing at a level where we're held within the bound, the binding effect of our conditioning. The more we see how bound we are by our conditioning, the more there is an intentional desire, so to speak, a spiritual desire to move beyond that conditioning. And that compelling desire, for lack of a better word, it's a yearning, because when I say desire, you say, oh, that's just, you just desire. No, this is a heartfelt, heart-stimulated yearning. Heart. Desire is a mind-generated, I want something. This is heartfelt. That heart yearns for freedom. And that has direct impact upon whether you wake up or not. It's the only thing. Isn't that amazing? It wasn't you lifting barbells every day. Now, the practices you do, we all do, are directly related to the urgency, to the yearning we feel. So it's not independent. Those two things are very dependent upon one another. But the practices we do are not the liberating effect. It's the intention that is the liberating effect. And if you want to deepen your practice and encourage that intention forward, we have to see the fix we're in. And most of us, that's not the side of Dharma that we want to go to. We want to see the beauty of it. We want to feel kinder and joyful and happier and loving, more loving. And so we emphasize the love, but we never see the fix we're in. We never see the containment of the jail cell. And it's until we see the fix we're in that the intention doesn't, it's just, it becomes a human intention to be a better person. That's That's the other side. It's not wrong to want to be a better person. It just ultimately doesn't lead to a deeper urgency to wake up. Makes you a very good neighbor, but it doesn't make you a free neighbor. So this is usually we have to go through years and years and years and years of practice before we develop the maturity, and it's almost incidental. You know, we see how conditioning affects us. We have somebody die in our life. We see that life isn't what it was promised to be. We're getting older. Somebody else is getting sick. It's like, what? Wait a minute now. I read about this in the literature, but it's getting personal now. What's going on? And suddenly you feel closed in, and we haven't developed the base camp of how to work with this stuff sufficiently to know to let it feed our truth and encourage a greater intention in us. And what I see from even people who have been practicing for long periods of time is that they haven't been practicing in coordination to live the truth they know. We have to let each of you in this room have had some degree of revelation, some degree, something that has inspired you to even want to seek a spiritual journey. That revelation, that sensing in yourself, is a truth in you. It wasn't self-manufactured. I think spirituality would be good for me. That would last about one sitting when you saw how hard it was. Right? Something else keeps you coming back. What is it that keeps us coming back? Land on that. Land on what you know about life that isn't being offered from this perspective, this recognition. And keep nurturing that forward. And commit, let us commit ourselves to living that truth. What I call awakened values. Values that come from having seen truth, sensed it, usually some form of interconnectedness or inclusivity or oneness or love or just honesty, something that I can compel forward. And then, of course, you have all the ways that the conditioned mind obstructs or tries to obstruct the truth that you've seen. And we have to find and refresh that truth over and over again in our lives. But the commitment to actually line ourselves up in accordance with that is the path forward. Path forward is a path to quiet, to stillness. Anatta is not desert. It's not being whisked away so that everything's black. It's just removing the filters of recognition so that you see the light of day, become the light of day, because the sense of me knowing is also removed. It's daylight, sunrise. It doesn't feel like we've missed anything. It feels just the opposite. It feels like we've gained everything. See, we've just been working it from the wrong end. We've just been working it from the wrong side of the equation. That's all. It's nothing. We haven't made mistakes. It's just that we keep trying to recognize ourselves through experience. And we think that there's going to be some revelation, some experience that's going to dispel all of this and lead us into the promised land. That's not how it happens. I think it's, I've been talking for 45 minutes, which is after 35 years of teaching, 45 minutes is like a little bell goes off in my mind, says these people need a bathroom break. So let me stop. We'll come back and we'll sit for half an hour, a guided meditation. So we'll take a silent break. You can go out and walk around 15 minutes, and we'll be back here at 1:30, okay? Good. See, once we understand how to move out of this spiritually, we begin to see how accessible the sacred is. As long as we're so self-defined and so knowledgeable about the boundaries of everything, there can't be any, there's no room for the sacred. We've cleared it out. We've abolished it. The formless cannot be. Only objects make sense to me. But as we begin to divest our attention in objects, space arises, but less definition. And so I'm at a crucial point there where I feel frightened to go into more space, but the suffering associated with the density I've come from. And this is then this gap, this space between the density and the space compels us for a long time. We go back to one, we aren't satisfied any longer because we've seen through that. We understand form sufficiently that we see that it undermines our well-being, our contentment, our peace, our sanity. We go back into space and less definition, and we're afraid of losing our self-definition. So at the greatest, so we try to make something out of the space that defines us by showing everybody how spacious we are, how wise we are. You see, we love to take this thing with ourselves, carry ourselves right through. And then we could have the best of both worlds. Just doesn't work that way. We don't really trust that there could be anything outside of the world we create. And so we make a decision, a very conscious one, to avoid the sacred. And yet the sacred holds everything. And this four foundations is a practical set of exercises to take us through form to the sacred. That's what it's meant to do. It's a direct path. It's a beautiful path. It's like finding the diamond in the rough. You go, oh, wow, how have I missed this? Because you've already seen that the solidity of form that we have invested in has a wide expanse of meaning here. It's not just body and digestive problems. But how, we might ask ourselves, what I have to realize that perceptions hold the forms and conflicts of the world, I have to have more detail here. This isn't enough. So the Buddha said, okay, I'll show you more detail. Let's go to the second foundation. Let's go to the next step in this thing and see how we create our life from nothing, from nothing. We got a sense of that in the first foundation, how we created the density of the body by just holding fast to the definitions we already know. But how are those definitions ever created? And they're so unconsciously coming forward all the time. How am I ever supposed to step out of that kind of thing? And I don't know why this thing keeps tapping like that. I'm assuming it's not something I'm doing. If it is, let me know. So he takes us to the second foundation. And the second foundation, when we investigate it, not just as an intellectual curiosity, oh yeah, this is, goes to that and that leads to that, I got it, okay, so on to the third foundation. No, actually seeing that we bring, that we are, this is a contingency, this is, we bring things from our past associations, we gather around life, we form it to be what it is. It's an active process. Formation of the reality we hold is an active and creative process that's going on all the time within us. And it starts out with feelings. Feelings being pleasant or unpleasant. The draw to approach something, or the resistance to seeing something, the aversion, or the neutrality that nothing's worth seeing. It's all bland. It's all... That sets the tone for the creative process to occur. And we begin to see that if something is appealing to me, it's a welcome invitation to memory, for memory to surround that thing, to show me why it's so appealing, why I'm drawn to it. But this is the important thing to remember. Objects don't have feelings. I have feelings that I project onto objects. This is all coming from me. I'm saying something is this way. It's not saying, it's not calling me, I'm calling it to me. Nothing has any value outside of what the mind gives it. I can feel the feelings I have about a nice turkey or nut loaf because I've tasted it before. It's great. So when it's in front of me, it does, it's just nothing. It's zero. It has no property except what I give. Oh, yes. Oh, God. Last year you made this one. Yeah, I think you made it a little better last year, but it's still... It brings me out of it, you see. I'm created out of it. I come into it. It's, I don't know if any of you have ever seen that Michelangelo sculpture where a person is coming out of stone. I can't remember the name of it, but it, like, he's coming out of stone, you know, and you can see this live figure coming out of, so it's an in that sense, it's an unfinished depiction of a human being, but it's very finished. And what I'm alluding to now is that we're coming out of our own persuasion. And we place that persuasion in front of us, and then we set that something up to feed us. How is that something going to feed us when it's us that's feeding it? It's only as long as my liking for it lasts that it will feed me. And it's not very long. I'm tired of turkey. Never mind. I'll tell you a story. Another story. Everything's calling me out. And I can see that the sense of me and the delight I give it are contingencies. They're two sides of the same tent. And my emotional content, what comes out in relationship to what I see, that's also from memory. And so the whole embellishment of mind, of attitude and thought and emotion and joy, because I had such great Thanksgivings in the past, and has nothing at all to do with reality. Thanksgiving is a Thursday. There are 52 of them in the course of a year. It's not even a Thursday. It's more of that. And so when we begin to see that we create ourselves from the projections of what we assert onto the world, And we see it. It's not like I get it intellectually. No, you see it. That's the beauty of awareness, is it shows us the entire mind. It shows us the whole scope of the mind. If we're willing to see at that level, if you want to see at that level, you'll see at that level. And you'll see it free of opinions, which validates awareness. If it was just an opinionation, then you would be seeing your mind in relationship to what you're visually seeing. But it's free of opinions. Because it's quiet, you can see the opinions forming as well. And because it's not of the mind, it can show us everything the mind is doing in relationship to what is being seen. And it shows us that nothing was ever what it was supposed to be. Whatever we thought it was, that's not what it is. And it shows us that we are self-creating it, that this is a hybrid. It's not me and the world, that these two things coexist. And we can see the pain in forcing the world outside of ourselves. And that's where the Buddha's taking us, you see. And most of us think, oh, I don't want to see that. I'll go in a different direction. Well, whatever direction we go, we've got to see the world is coming from us. That's an essential insight. And so we learn how to challenge the mind as the mind rather than to simply assert its truth. We feel bored. What am I making of this moment? Why am I making boredom in this moment? Not why is the moment boring to me, but why am I boring the moment? Because it's not entertaining enough. I can be with that. I can see my need for entertainment. That's just more feeling tone. That's the aversion of not having entertainment. That's a feeling. Okay, I can feel that. And the boredom is the waiting for this feeling to pass so that I can have something entertaining to invest in. I can sit. That's great. Good. I'm right on top of it. And through the interest in what we're seeing, boredom can't subsist, can't sustain itself, because it requires the absence of interest. And now you're interested in boredom. It's very interesting how this works. In every state of mind, at some point, we take it on. Okay, what? Okay. As something seen its completion, it doesn't mean anything in relation. It's totally self-accountable. We're totally self-accountable here. So now you can feel the subtlety where he's bringing us. You feel it? We can always go back there. We can always journey to one. We don't have to go 1, 2, 3, 4 out. You can go 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 1, 1. If you get scared, there's always one. But let me take you to 3. It's my favorite. So now the Buddha says, okay, so now you're seeing that you're self-creating in the world, you're self-creating. And you also have a sense that is through your argument with the world, your disagreement with feelings, that this tension of self and world creates itself. So now I'm going to take you to the third foundation, in which we're not going to create. Whatever is occurring as it's occurring. We're not going to counter what's occurring with its opposite logic. If I am concentrated or not concentrated, if I am happy, if I am not happy, if I am angry, if I am not angry, if I'm happy, if I'm this, if I'm that. He could go through the whole list of 20,000 different states of mind, but he doesn't. He saves us from that. He says, there will be no opposite to what is perceived. We will not set up an opposite. That's essentially what he's saying. Now here's the crucial element in this that can be seen very clearly from this advantage point. That is, when we're not bickering, self-bickering, when there isn't one part of the mind wishing for a different reality than the reality is perceiving, that's a divided mind. That's a mind that's in contrast to itself. And that's what the Buddha is taking away from us in the third foundation. Because he's ceasing the argument. Stop arguing. Cease the argument. Or, said differently, allow all arguments to be in full volume and don't counter them. That's the same thing I just said. I don't like this. I don't like it. And then it just peters out. You see, don't contrast it with anything. Suddenly, that which was divisive and therefore created the sense of inward tension necessary for me to part from the world becomes unified because there's no opposite point of view being taken. Now he's showing us what the world looks like when feelings aren't governing it. And it's amazing. If ever you have been in that place where it's not what is being said, but now you're the whole. Once the bickering stops, the mind is no longer the center of focus. That which holds the mind becomes the center. The unification is not in the mind. The mind has stopped dividing. When it stops dividing, it too is empty, and it falls into the universality of awareness. It is held in birth out of stillness, and it's from stillness. It is not a mind anymore because there's nothing in there that's describably pointing to itself. I know this is subtle dharma, and if it don't let it discourage you, everyone has the potential, if you wish, to see and free yourself at this level. Now let me show you the world from this unified point of view. Because there's no opposition in unification, the perception is of perfection. Perfection. Everywhere you look, what is perceived in its totality is perfectly itself. Perfectly itself. Unalterably itself. There's no opposition to anything. There's no attempt to change or manipulate or distort. Okay, for those of you who are social activists, that does not in any way jeopardize your ability to move with the awakened values of inclusivity when you don't see that, with social justice when you don't see that, with peace when you don't see that. So it sounds like a contradiction, but it is not a contradiction. And many people who are social activists don't want to see from this point of view because they think it will take away their very righteousness that they govern their lives by. It does not take away your righteousness. It does take away your righteousness. It doesn't take away the journey of awakened values, the movement towards awakened values. And if the world is going to heal, it has to heal through awakened values, not through righteousness. We're no better off than the opposite side, period, no matter how much evidence you can prove to the contrary. It's at that level of honesty that we have to go. You see, when you see from that level in which there is no contradiction, there's no me, because I manifest from contradiction. The sense of I is in perpetual conflict. God. Do you want to come this way? You see? We still have another foundation. Let's take a break and meet back at 10 till, 20 till for the conclusion. Is not that we stay, most of us do not stay within the formless state. We keep coming back into form, and so we should, because it's not a matter of grasping and holding to the formless any more than it was to grasp and hold form. Any grasping, and I am sure to be there. So it's the movement of what's relevant rather than the location of what I need to call permanent. And it's the sliding of that scale. It's, oh, okay, so I need to do something functional. I need to know your name. I need to know mine. I need to know how to drive home and where my car is parked. I can't let, okay, I just be quiet and let God give me, that this doesn't work. Parking my Campbell at the post doesn't give me more any more information. So it's the, this is so beautiful. It's not the, we don't try to get to a certain location and as this is the sacred. It's the absence of polarities that are the sacred. It's the absence of contraction. It's when I'm called out to know you and you know me and we have a conversation, that's freedom. But my mind isn't held there when the situation changes and the space opens up. Consciousness changes in accordance to what is called for in that moment, and a different form or expression of consciousness comes. Oneness. God consciousness, emptiness, these are all expressions of consciousness. They're limitless. Object consciousness, that's an expression of consciousness. All of those have relevance at certain interactions. And each one feels completely sufficient in itself. Doesn't this one feel completely sufficient? I know how to manage that, and I got this, I've got things to do tomorrow, and God, this neighbor, I can master that. I've got a lawsuit on this guy. I mean, it's all right? It's completely sufficient in itself. Emptiness is completely sufficient too. It's like, who cares? It's all empty. And it's true, relatively. And God consciousness, universal consciousness. See, it's not the expression of consciousness, it's where all those expressions are derived. It's what holds all of that, not the experience of that. Now, in the fourth foundation, this is the setup. Formlessness is where we land in the fourth foundation. It's the given. That's what the first three foundations took us to. But that doesn't mean that we aren't going to get caught up in one of the expressions of consciousness. We're going to get in turmoil. We're going to get in conflict. So the Buddha says, remember the teaching to get yourself out, freed from that level and expression of consciousness. So he says, you see, there's nothing he could say about awareness because it doesn't have any qualities to it. It just holds all qualities. You can't say it's this way because it holds this way. You can't say it's that way because it holds that way. And I'm reacting to that, and it holds that. You see, it holds everything. It's not itself a thing. It's formless. And therefore, it's very, for a long period of time, at least in my experience, you get caught back up. You get caught within each expression of consciousness. It never made sense to me to contemplate the teachings as an end in itself. It never made sense to me. Oh, that's one of the four foundations. Oh, that's one of the three characteristics. Oh, that's one of the seven factors of enlightenment. Oh, that's one of the four noble truths. All that does is reform you, put you into the knowledge base of yourself, reforming yourself again and again, using the Buddha's teaching now to undermine your freedom. But to use it to release, to surrender back into freedom, so that now in the spaciousness of the awareness, when I'm feeling something rub inside of me, I go, oh yeah, surrender. Surrender. You take all the Buddha's teachings and put them into a funnel. Okay, cram them all in there. 7, this is 4, this is 6, that's 8, 9, 10, 12, 15. Put them all in the funnel. Let it all come down. The last thing, the thing that comes out, surrender. That's it. Release. That's what this is supposed to do. And we need reminders that each expression of consciousness is a limitation, not a completion. And it's only through surrender that that becomes obvious. And so the final foundation is a foundation based in surrender. And that's what the Buddhist teachings were always meant to do in service. He's not trying to make us a Buddhist. Okay, Rodney, what's the four foundations? Oh, no. Get out of here. You're not worth it. Who knows the seven factors? We're not taking a test here. We're being quiet. We're learning to be still. So let us, one final guided meditation from the third foundation. If you'd like to stand up and stretch. So I want to open this for any questions or comments you might have. So please. Yes, sir. Did anyone hear that? I just didn't hear.
Is the formless the equivalent of the sacred?
Yes, the formless is the sacred, yes. Okay, right, yes.
I was just trying to get a different meaning of the sacred.
Yes. What keeps us from knowing the sacred is our investment in form. The sacred isn't somewhere else, it's here. It's just that we're too interested in making that thing what we want it to be, coming from us, so we don't allow the sacred to show itself. We're more interested in the object than the sacred. And so we have to use statues to even remind us that there is a sacred. And so we keep those things around us until you sense the sacred is at all times. And then those things are nice, but they're ornamental, not, you see? So the sacred, yes. And I have a page in the book where the terminology is defined. So I hope that that is helpful to you.
So is awareness then something outside of the brain?
It's not outside in the sense that it's here and the brain is here. It's all encompassing.
It's not independent.
It is independent of the brain, and it is also infiltrates the brain completely. So it's completely independent of the brain in the sense that it's dependent upon the brain for its existence. It's not. It's not dependent upon the brain for its existence. It's the simile, the analogy that is the space in the room. It holds all the objects that pass through that space. It's not dependent upon any object for its embrace. It holds all things, doesn't it? In fact, as you go into your body and mind, you'll see a lot of space there. So it even infiltrates the very substance that we think of as being different than the space. Awareness is very much like that. Okay? In fact, what happens when you start working feelings is you begin to sense the transparency of objects, how they are nothing and we make them something. And as we begin to see how we're making them something, we can begin to sense their transparency within awareness, that they owe their life, you might say, to awareness. That they don't exist outside. Form and formlessness sound like two different things, but they're actually one and the same thing when they're seen in proper perspective to one another. And that's why I can have an interpersonal relationship and it doesn't do anything to my spiritual. I don't say, oh, I have to get rid of all these people in order to. There's no in order to, because the sacred is with everything.
So is awareness then independent of me? Is awareness independent
of me? The me is a perspective. It's a way of looking. It's a way of translating the world. Okay? When there's the me, there's the translation of the world into what I know it to be. Because that's what the me does. That's what the me is. It's a knowledge-based, memory-based perspective that projects its meaning and its knowledge onto the world. And then it takes a position within that knowledge, and I calling itself knowledgeable. When we release the need to hold that space, and we're the one that holds that space, we encourage that space, we encourage the development of it and the isolation of it. Because we want to be that person who knows. And when we invest in anything like that, that perspective holds itself. There are many perspectives that we won't allow to show themselves because that's the perspective we want. You see? So as we begin to perceive what the sense of self is, not trashing it or attacking it, but just simply seeing what it is, it becomes transparent too, like all the other objects. And it, you see that it's self-induced. And so it's when it's perceived correctly, it's surrendered. It's just not, it just doesn't become the rule of life. And the whole thing becomes much more interrelatable, much more interchangeable than it was when it was held under a self-centered perspective. Now things can move and things can join, and the heart can become functional within the joining of things, rather than it's not a functional heart in isolation. Its only function is to concern itself, because that's what I do, as I keep it contained within me. Everything serves me, self-improvement, everything is about me. I want to be more loving. I want, you see? That's not true love. That's self-centered, that's me, the me's approach to the heart. Love is when I am not. It's not something I have to build up and manufacture to try to make. It is. Anna, do you have some?
Thank you. When you were talking about feeling tone, I suddenly realized, oh, I've been demonizing feeling tone. I've been thinking desire's bad and aversion is bad. And then I saw perhaps the one way to look at the foundations is that the Buddha is pointing out all these things that I'm demonizing, that I'm separating from, that I'm creating self around by opposite. So especially when you talk about the funnel, I thought that's exactly it. It's all these things going to the funnel that I'm supposed to surrender. The idea is surrendering to all those. They exist whether I demonize them or not. And it's my demonization that is causing my suffering, not the fact that they're there.
Okay, so let's go back. I said at some point that you are not responsible for what the mind does. When I realized that, that's tremendously freeing. All the thoughts you have, the hideous things you think about, all of that, it's not your responsibility. It's not up, you didn't do it. Okay? It's coming out. So just let it come out. What does it matter? Your job is to see it. So, because when it first comes out, you want to do something with it. The seeing buffers that need to change it. That's what seeing does. It sees that that's okay. That's what seeing does. The okayness comes from the seeing. What I don't like about what I see comes from me, comes from the mind. So I just let it be by seeing it. Seeing it sees it. It doesn't have a quality associated with it. Seeing doesn't have an argument, it doesn't have a judgment. It's just seeing. Now, okay, let's just see for a moment, because I like to, okay, let's just see. And as soon as you offer yourself that opportunity, you get a sense, oh yeah, seeing. I can dance in seeing. I can even make a mistake in seeing. Seeing doesn't criticize me. It doesn't push me. It doesn't shame me. There's no remorse in seeing. I make a mistake, I spill water. It's all seeing. You see? There you go. Now it's like, okay, now life could be, what could be, oh yeah, right, okay, right. So you turn your life over to seeing. Now that doesn't mean that I have to, okay, how are you? Yeah, Jim, yes, yeah, I remember exactly, yes. How do you want me to sign your book? Jim or James? All right. All of that is a part of it. It's an expression of it. It's the form acting as form. It's not one thing that we're trying to get to and at the expense of the other. All of this comes back in. All of it comes back in. But we're not stuck in any one position. most of us in the room are stuck in a position and we're not seeing. And that means we're being driven by our conditioning, by our habits. And that's the equation for suffering. That's the formula for why we suffer. Follow your habits, your conditioning, and you'll suffer. Guaranteed. Because the habits keep trying to make the world work and according to how it's been. That's how habit is formed. I remember this situation, although that was, where's that picture I really like? Okay, that's what a habit does. It preforms existence. Seeing doesn't perform existence. It allows existence to be existence. It doesn't have an assumption based within existence of how, you see? So you turn your life over to seeing, it opens up. You keep it conditioned and you're always like, oh, no. It's like that. It has to make sense to you. This has to make sense. It has to be grounded sense. I see what suffering is. I see what I need to do. I see where this is going. This makes sense. It's fun. Believe it or not. Yes, sir.
Papa read this phrase, and I'm just curious on your take. Is that formless nothingness, nothingness form?
Yeah.
Does that make sense against the backdrop of the four foundations?
Yes. That's what the four foundations show you. They show you form, and then they show you what form is. It's nothing. And then they show you that form is something at some points, and then they show you that it's nothing at other points. It shows you that. You realize that. Then you can play within those two dynamics. Right? So form is form, nothing is nothing, and form is nothing, and nothing is something. In fact, nothing is something when you make it something. Like, I'm empty. Now you made something out of nothing. You see? It's just that simple. Okay.
First of all, I just wanted to thank you for being here. It's so good to have you back. And I very much appreciate you talking about social justice activists, because I'm one, or try to be one. And so I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about that, because I don't see any, kind of an intuitive sense, I don't see any incongruence between a spiritual path and doing that work. I know that as activists, we are fighting for something, so there is that conflict. And I hear you talk about the righteousness, which certainly, especially if I can say in younger people, I know when I was in my 20s, I was, you know, my way or the highway kind of thing. So I'm hoping as I'm older, it's not that way. But could you speak more about that, especially? I mean,
sure.
I really know it's not incongruent, but I'm wondering if you could speak more.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I'm glad they're social activists. You know, I'm not belittling it at all. It's just that's one expression that the formless takes is social activism. There's lots of expressions. It always takes an expression of love. But there are people's character and temperament are part of how that manifests. Okay, so but. Mostly we get to a certain point in spirituality where we feel increasingly hostile to those who are not seeing inclusion and or not seeing kindness or not acting kind. There's a greater reactivity that can happen within those who are spiritually practiced than those who aren't, because it's so upsetting to the very fundamental values we hold when we see those things violated, okay? And so one of two things happen for most people. One of those is that you retreat from it at all. You say, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to go hide in the sand. The other is that you get righteous. We get righteous. And the righteousness means that we aren't sufficiently mature in our spiritual journey, because the righteousness really creates the same conditions for that which we are protesting to occur, to reoccur. It really does. Trump is not an individual. Trump is universal consciousness, people. It's all of us. We're all Trump. Swallow your Trump. Understand this. This is not about individuals. There is no Trump as an individual. It's an expression of consciousness. Consensual. And yet we keep forcing that into a package outside of ourselves where we don't own those same properties and make him the enemy. This is just going to perpetuate him giving birth to guess what? Trumps. He already did. When are we going to end this? You see, this is not, this is really serious stuff now. We're evolving, please let the passion come out. We're now to the point where humanity is at the precipice of its own end. And we haven't learned the lessons on how to continue. And if you don't think that's social action, then there's something wrong. If you don't think what I'm doing today is social action, there's something you're missing completely in this. And when you find a value that is so true to you because you've seen the truth of it and you're willing to sign any petition, picket any demonstration, because that value is so true to you. But that truth is not going to let you create an enemy. It's going to be truth for its own sake. Period. And it will take you anywhere, including jail. And we're willing to go there. I have one of the highest expressions of the Dharma for me is truth. And it's being butchered. If we don't have truth to guide us, we have nothing. We have nothing. So every time I hear something, nope, that's not correct. Nope. And I'll talk about it. I'll say, no, 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 no. I will do whatever is necessary because that's a compelling value for me. Okay? But I will not make an enemy of untruth. I will not set it up because that's an untruth in itself. That there is an enemy. And I would try to resolve the enemy I'm creating by forming more enemies, which is forming more untruths. Won't do that. I'm not going to do that. Now let it come. Okay. Yes, sir.
Is the resolution between opposites something that you realize intuitively when you shift to the perspective? It's not just at a logical conclusion that you make, eventually you actually your brain shifts and understands it experientially.
See, what the mind does is it forms itself by, it says this is right and this is wrong. That's how it works. Once you understand that this mind is never going to become benign, it's always going to be assertive. It's always going to say this is true and this isn't. It's always going to side take. It's always going to level off opposites, right? Okay, so, but awareness doesn't do that. Awareness holds both opposites. So our job is to hold both opposites. That doesn't mean that we stumble about which way to do it. You let something else take you forward. And that's what I mean by love, really. It knows its way, and its way isn't through opposition. And yet its way is very direct, it's very assertive, it can be very assertive, it can be very forceful, it can be very manifest. It just doesn't create the opposites that the mind needs in order to survive. So, if we're going to live free of the mind, we have to live free of that opposition, free of those opposites. That doesn't mean I think up is down, because functionally, I can't live like that. Functionally, I have to know that one thing is and one thing. That doesn't mean that I hold that as the truth in my life, though. That's the way I navigate the world. Okay, all. Okay. Maybe we just take 1-2 minutes and just be quiet. Okay.